This is Corolla Digital.
This is We the People.
What is wrong with our country?
I don't want to believe what you believe, and you can't make.
I want to hear why it's bad to feel good.
These two political gangs don't have your best interest in mind.
Makes me proud to be an American. Makes me even smarter to be off the grid.
Stay vigilant, people.
Abraham, light up that joint.
Welcome back to our second edition of We the People with Jesse Ventura. Today, I'm welcoming acclaimed wrestler, musician, author, and host of his own podcast, Talk is Jericho, the one and only Chris Jericho. But first, let's go to my vigilant producer, Alex Logan. Alex, what do you have in store for us today?
Well, Governor, before we get to the headlines, there are a few pundits who have offered their opinion on your court case, and I think your vigilant listeners will want to know what you have to say in response. First up, Anderson Cooper posted this on Twitter. I cannot believe that Jesse Ventura successfully sued the widow of a fallen Navy SEAL. Has he no shame?
Well, first of all, Anderson Cooper doesn't know a thing about this case because he hasn't seen one shred of actual evidence. He was never in the courtroom at all, so he doesn't know what evidence is in the case or not. And I did not sue a widow and her children. I sued the estate of Chris Kyle. That suit took place January of 2012. He did not die until February, I believe, of 2013. So when his wife, Taya, took over as executor of the estate, she knew the lawsuit was part of it. She knew that when she chose to do it. She didn't have to come into the lawsuit. She made a choice to come into the lawsuit. The executor of an estate can be a lawyer, it can be a brother, it can be an uncle, it can be anyone can be named the executor of an estate. So she made the choice to come into this trial, and I believe that choice was made for the precise reason Anderson Cooper's defending, to make it look like I sued a widow and her children. And you know, Anderson Cooper didn't realize that she had insurance. Insurance paid for everything. I didn't have insurance. I had to pay for everything myself. And he also doesn't know that during settlement talks, I offered to drop it for no money if they would simply give me back my reputation, admit it was fabricated, and we'd move on. They told me that wouldn't happen. The only thing they would talk is money. They tried to buy me out of this. I wouldn't take it because I wanted my reputation. Go ahead and continue on, Alex.
Next up, Sarah Palin had this to say. Hey, tough guy Jesse Ventura, your feelings were hurt because you perceived your reputation was besmirched by words in a book, so you turn around and sue. Yeah, like that is going to help your reputation, jackass.
Well, you know what I got to say to Sarah, the quitter Palin? At least I finished my term, Sarah, and didn't lie to the people. You lied to the people. You told the people of Alaska you wanted to be their governor. And then all of a sudden, fame and fortune came your way, and being governor really wasn't that important, was it, to the money? So you dropped out early. You quit your job as governor. You didn't fulfill your obligation and your promise to the very people who elected you. You chose fame and fortune, Sarah. I have no respect for you because you made a choice. You took the money over your obligation. So who are you to criticize me?
Lastly, Bill O'Reilly said that despite your victory, you remain deeply unpopular and you need the money because you are, and I quote, unemployable, really, political career over, he got into the conspiratorial thing, 9/11 truther, that's what I think happened there.
Well, there you go. O'Reilly, as usual, is making my point that truth is a bad connotation. Now, if he'd have called me, let's see a quote here, if he'd have called me a 9/11 liar, well, that might have been good, right, Bill O'Reilly? Because the word truth is not good anymore. Let's talk about who employs Bill O'Reilly. News Corp owns Fox News, and they also own HarperCollins, the very people that published the book. So Bill O'Reilly's not a truthful person. He doesn't tell you, him and Sarah Palin, that they have a conflict of interest. They both work for Fox News, who signs their paychecks, and HarperCollins is the book company that wrote the book that defamed me. Notice how Bill O'Reilly doesn't tell his listeners about his very own conflict of interest. I think that's fairly important, Bill, but apparently you don't, because that's right, you're not a truth seeker, you're a liar.
Jess Cohen at Forbes.com weighed in. Commentators today are marveling at how a man who has such a high-profile athlete, politician, celebrity entertainer, and who therefore was a legitimate target for all sorts of public accusations, could win this case. Jesse fought to restore his brand, which is what he called his good name, and he won. No need to move to Mexico. The Ventura brand can stay all American.
Well, that's sure nice to hear that there's actually a pundit that looked at the case logically and responded to it accordingly. I am pleased with that response and from that particular pundit, because I think he's right on in what he's saying right there.
Now, this next one is from the Tea Party News Network. It's summation written by Jennifer Burke. She writes, many are outraged that Ventura continued his lawsuit after Chris Kyle's death and are even more outraged at the size of the verdict. According to CBS News, Ventura feels no remorse for his actions. His targeting of a woman left widowed with two young children has drawn outrage.
Well, see, there's your classic example. The lawsuit was filed before she was a widow. You notice they don't put that in there. The lawsuit was filed in January of 2012, and she was not a widow at that time. Read it back to me one more time.
Many are outraged that Ventura continued his lawsuit after Chris Kyle's death and are even more outraged at the size of the verdict.
Stop right there. The size of the verdict. I had nothing to do with that. That was the jury. That's the system. So they're outraged at the jury and the jury's decision. These people who did not hear one word of the case, they were not sitting there, they saw no evidence whatsoever, and yet they can make a statement that they're outraged at the size of the award, and then they finish it by taking it from this widow and her children who can't afford it. They've made $6 million off the book alone up to this point. It's going to a movie that Clint Eastwood's going to direct. So how many millions more will be made off the movie? And guess who propelled it to all that height? Jesse Ventura. He brought it into the limelight. The jury agreed. And when you look at the facts and you look at the case, you'll agree too. To all these people, I tell them, get the trial transcripts and read them before you talk about it.
And I continue on this one. According to CBS News, Ventura feels no remorse for his actions. His targeting of a woman left widowed with two young children has drawn outrage.
No remorse? I'm clearing my name. Seeking the truth, you should have to have remorse? As I said earlier, I guess there's a second set of laws in this country for widows. I guess a widow can profit from slander. A widow can profit from defamation. I don't believe it should be that way. I think the law is the law, and it should apply equally to everyone, and there shouldn't be exceptions made to that.
Now for some social media questions and comments.
Sure.
Bruce Gordon on Facebook says, the real point of this whole thing is that Chris is dead. The classy thing to do would have been to drop the lawsuit after he died.
No, that's not the real point of it. The real point is the truth. How can the truth be bad? I think that shows mightily on our society. I had to clear my name, and the suit was filed before Mr. Kyle tragically died, unfortunately. But they would never, in the 2.5 years, do one thing to restore my reputation. The only way I could do that was go into court and have the court and the jury restore my reputation, and the jury did that.
Here's one that we thought was a common misconception. Casey Clendenin on Facebook wrote, just lost all respect for Ventura. If the bar fight was such a big issue, why wait 8 years and a year after Chris Kyle was murdered just to sue his wife?
Well, see, there's the classic example of someone who doesn't know shit. I didn't even learn of this till January of 2012. That's hardly 8 years ago, and I couldn't refer back to 8 years ago because it never happened. Clear enough there, writer? Remember this, and this came out in trial. Even the publicist for the book and the statistics showed that when Kyle said that I was the person he punched out, prior to that, the book had sold 5,000. After he did that, the next day they ordered 100,000 be printed. So it went from 5,000 to 100,000 in 24 hours.
This one is from Randy Cox on Facebook. Actually, Kyle told the truth. It was supported by many witnesses. The jury concluded that Ventura was defamed from the truth.
Well, no, Kyle didn't tell the truth, and his witnesses didn't either. Here you got another example of somebody talking for witnesses who wasn't in the courtroom. Initially, he said he struck me out on the street, and I went down and hit my head on a curb and didn't get up. If you read the book, it was inside he hit me and tables and chairs flew. There were no 11 witnesses. All the witnesses had credibility gaps that were huge. The jury saw that. I produced three or four witnesses that were with me all night and said nothing happened. There was no altercation. There were photographs. There was so much evidence, it was overwhelming.
There are plenty of supporters out there, like Deb Carlson on Facebook, who wrote in, "How would all of you feel if it was you or a family member mentioned in some book with made-up stories or lies? If you have a moral compass and care about your family, you would want to fight back."
Exactly. And that's all that I did. I did exactly what that writer said. Put yourself in a position where someone has told a major lie about you, got it published. It's all out there throughout the world, this lie. And your family has to see this lie and has to live with this lie. And you're given only one recourse: go to court. Because the other side isn't going to admit it. They never did. Through this entire 2.5 years, they told me the only thing we'll talk about is money. And yet people tell me I'm wrong for seeking the truth. I don't think so. I can look into the mirror. Can you? My closing thoughts are this. I'll certainly be happy when this is gone and behind me, but I will continue to fight and defend myself even though I shouldn't have to. A jury has ruled, the system has worked, and people, you need to accept that. That's the society we live in. The truth prevailed, and the truth has set me free.
Well, let's move on to those headlines, Governor.
Yep.
So we thought this story might be right in your wheelhouse. A Sky News Australia report this week stated that just one day before September 11, 2001, former President Bill Clinton told an audience that he could have had Osama bin Laden killed, but chose not to, because an attack could have endangered innocent women and children in Afghanistan. Well, when you first heard this story, were you shocked, Governor?
No, I wasn't shocked at all. I'm sure the president had that opportunity, but I think he made the correct decision, because at the time, what right do we have to go kill someone in Afghanistan? 9/11 hadn't happened. So we just have the arbitrary right to go throughout the world, and if somebody we dislike or feel is a threat to us, we can just kill them? No trial, no indictment, no nothing. See, that's the problem, people. We have our own government not even following the system of law. And if your government is lawless and doesn't follow the system of law, then why should the rest of us? Notice, in my case, against Chris Kyle, I followed the system of law, didn't I? I did it the way it's supposed to be done, in court. How do you arbitrarily go out and kill people throughout the world without first charging them with a crime and convicting them? I think that's quite important.
Well, Clinton spoke to businessmen in Australia and said, "I nearly got him, and I could have killed him, but I would have had to destroy a little town called Kandahar in Afghanistan and kill 300 innocent women and children, and then I would have been no better than him, and so I didn't do it."
Good for you, Bill Clinton. You held yourself to a higher esteem, as our president should, and you also didn't torture. Notice the road we went down after you left. We now torture, too, on orders from our president and vice president.
And it doesn't seem to fall in line with our current administration's drone wars, either.
No, it doesn't. You know, these drone things, again, if we're not going to be a country that runs by the rule of law, then what do we stand for? You can't just follow the law when it's convenient. You have to also follow it when it's inconvenient. Bill O'Reilly... And Sarah Palin and Anderson Cooper can verify that you have to follow the law even when you don't agree with it or it's inconvenient. Those three better take note of that. It's the law, and it works most of the time.
Well, as the LA Times states, the latest news is more than just a sad footnote. There have been long complaints in some conservative quarters about Clinton's actions in failing to neutralize bin Laden. Reuters reports that the 9/11 Commission report recounts an episode in December 1998 where Clinton's administration considered a cruise missile strike to kill bin Laden, the Saudi Arabian founder of Al-Qaeda, after learning he would be in Kandahar. The strike was not launched because of the fear that perhaps 300 other people could be killed or injured, the report says.
Well, as well it should be. We were not at war then. How can we just go out throughout the world and start shooting cruise missiles at people we don't particularly like? You know, who's next? Fidel Castro? We're going to send a cruise missile down to Fidel because we don't like him either? Come on, people. I'm as patriotic as anybody, but let's remember something. If we don't hold our government's feet to the fire, our government can become bad also. Remember, governments are made up of people, and people can be evil.
Well, next up is the latest on the NSA. Documents obtained by Edward Snowden and published this past Monday by The Intercept's Glenn Greenwald revealed the far-reaching extent of the agency's collaboration with Israeli intelligence services. According to Newsweek, what's unusual is that in these new documents, Israel was identified by the NSA as a security threat in several areas, including the threat of development of weapons of mass destruction and delivery methods. The NSA also flagged WMD and missile proliferation activities and cruise missiles as threats.
Wait a minute. Am I missing something? I thought the Israelis already had nuclear weapons. I think every country in the world that has nuclear weapons is a potential risk. They all have them. All it takes is one nut inside the country or whoever's running it to decide to use them. Every country in the world that has nuclear weapons is a risk, including us. We're the only ones that who have actually used them. So the proof's in the pudding, isn't it?
In other news regarding covert operations, the AP just released a big story. According to the Associated Press, our own government sent Latin youth undercover in an anti-Cuba ploy. Over the last 2 years, the AP alleges the U.S. Agency for International Development, best known for overseeing billions of dollars in U.S. humanitarian aid, sent nearly a dozen neophytes from Venezuela, Costa Rica, and Peru, and deployed them to Cuba to gin up opposition against the Cuban government. They did this under the guise of civic programs, such as an HIV prevention workshop, and also posed as tourists visiting college campuses to recruit political activists.
Right there you see why the rest of the world hates us. What has Cuba done to us to warrant this? Existed? Just because they have a different government that we don't particularly take fashion to, communism, we do this to them, we now attack them. The United States practices its own brand of terrorism. Yes, I've used that before. That's how I got kicked off Fox News. Because I said, why is it okay for the United States to practice terrorism against Cuba? Cuba's never done one thing to us. They've never done one thing to the United States. And yet here we are now, hiding things under humanitarian reasons, all done to try to undermine their government. So it's okay for us to practice terrorism against Cuba, but woe be if someone practices it against us. You know, our double standard, the hypocrisy is astounding. Fidel Castro and the Cubans have done nothing to us for 50 years. They simply have a government that won't allow our corporations to come in and prosper. That's why we hate them. That's why we hate the communism in Cuba, because corporations aren't allowed in, and we love the communism in China because China allows our corporations in. Anybody see the big picture here of who's really running United States foreign policy? It's called corporations, people. They're the ones running us, not our elected officials.
Well, the AP reports that one of these undercover youths was instructed to check in every 48 hours and was provided with a set of security codes, such as, I have a headache, which meant that the youth thought the mission should be suspended for fear of being watched. The kicker, Governor, some travelers were paid as little as $5.41 an hour.
Not even minimum wage? So they screwed them on minimum wage, too. Why would the traveler except to do this for $5.41 an hour. These people snuck into Cuba and potentially put their lives on the line for $5.41 an hour? United States government should be ashamed in more ways than one. Geez, at least pay a minimum wage. Well, but I guess since it's Cuba, minimum wage wasn't required, was it? Oh, and maybe, Alex, they got all the free Cuban cigars they could smoke.
Just as long as they left them there, right? Not bringing them back.
Yeah, no bringing them back. You got to smoke them there. You can't bring them back in.
Well,
contraband.
In response to this report, Representative Ileana Ross-Leighton of Florida said USAID's programs were important for human rights in Cuba. She told the AP, "We must continue to pressure the Castro regime and support the Cuban people who are oppressed on a daily basis." Ross-Leighton is a Cuban native and vocal supporter of pro-democracy programs in Cuba.
And that's wonderful for her, but I think she ought to look into her own backyard first and start looking at the police state that we covered here on my show that's going on right inside our own country. That's our problem, people. All our elected officials are worried about what's going on in the rest of the world, and they're not even taking care of our own country. Democrats and Republicans don't care about you or our own country. They're more interested in the corporate, international corporate world than they are you.
Let's go to the world of golf, because I know you love golf, Governor. It seems the future is uncertain for Tiger Woods. The former world number one and 14-time major champion's pro golf career hangs in the balance of his own health. According to USA Today, Woods has had a left knee that has gone under the knife four times, a back that was operated on March 31st to alleviate pain caused by a pinched nerve, and battles with other assorted injuries, including his Achilles, neck, and elbow. That's a lot for an athlete to bear. Even someone like Tiger Woods, who was once thought of as an undefeatable in the world of golf. Governor, you're an avid golfer. Can Tiger Woods come back?
He can. I'm not giving up on him. But let me state this. Everybody kind of laughs at golf because you really don't sweat or get dirty. And yet look at the list of injuries that Tiger Woods sustained there. He's as good an athlete as there is out there on the planet in any sport. And golf is a lot tougher than people think it is. Otherwise, why would he have surgery four times on his knee? Why would he have back surgery and all the other mishaps he's had to face? Because golf, believe it or not, is a tough and demanding sport, especially when you play it at Tiger's level. Look at the violence when Tiger swings and the torquing of his body. Those aren't necessarily natural movements, and he's paying the price for them the same as all athletes do in the end. If you're going to be a pro athlete, you have to learn to understand that when you get 50 years old, you're going to pay the price for the fame, the fortune, and the stardom.
So U.S. Captain Tom Watson says Woods' latest back injury doesn't bode well right now for Woods playing in the next month's Ryder Cup. His agent says Woods hasn't been ruled out of the PGA Championship, which he needs to win to make it into the Ryder Cup. So, Governor, is there hope for Tiger? Are you a Tiger fan?
Absolutely, there's hope for Tiger Woods. He just had back surgery. Everyone's expecting miracles immediately, including himself. He needs to realize it may take a year or two. But I am a Tiger Woods fan, and I think he belongs on the Ryder Cup. How can you take the greatest golfer or one of the top three greatest golfers in U.S. history and leave him off the Ryder Cup? Let Tiger win or lose it on the golf course. Don't take it away from him unless he's too injured to play. If he's too injured to play, well, then naturally he shouldn't be a member of the Ryder Cup. But if you want ratings, which I know they do because that translates into money, Tiger Woods better be on that team or you're not going to get the ratings, and statistics prove that.
How about your favorite golfer of all time?
My favorite golfer of all time is probably Arnold Palmer, because of only for personal reasons. I've actually played two 18-hole rounds with the King, and it was a pleasure to do so. He's a gentleman and a wonderful man. And only because I've played two complete rounds with Arnold Palmer would he rank as my favorite.
Fantastic drink as well, the Arnold Palmer.
Yeah. Well, you've made it big when you have a drink in every clubhouse in America named after you.
What would the Jesse Ventura be?
My drink?
Yeah.
Today?
Yeah.
Mineral water.
Mineral water.
Not too exciting, Alex.
So that's all for this week's headlines, but every Tuesday through Friday, we tackle the tough stories on Aura TV's Off the Grid.
Thank you. The good headlines. And I feel good having those national pundits ripping me. Because if those national pundits are ripping me, people like Anderson Cooper, Sarah Palin, Bill O'Reilly, and the conflict of interest people, then that tells me I'm doing it right. Because if they were complimenting me, I'd be doing it wrong.
Now here's a few highlights from last week's shows on Aura TV.
I want to thank Matt Taibbi for joining me. He is my man. Matt and I worked together on Conspiracy Theory, and he was the guy I'd go to, because if there's one guy that knows the criminals and the corruption of Wall Street, it's Matt. Because he wrote for Rolling Stone magazine, he exploited all that, and he is my encyclopedia on Wall Street, and I make no bones about it. Now, dealing, I never heard of this Holder memo until you brought it to light here, but dealing with this situation, is this an example of the corporate takeover of our government?
Absolutely.
That way. Yeah, absolutely. This is
absolutely.
With those decisions the Supreme Court has done where corporations can now channel literally millions, almost billions of dollars to buy the Democrats and Republicans and the elected officials. So it's really the corporations taking control and taking over our country to where we citizens have no say-so anymore. Would that be accurate?
I think it's incredibly accurate. I mean, I think the best example of that was last year. The Department of Justice was about to file a lawsuit against JPMorgan Chase. They actually announced a press conference that they were going to where they were going to announce this sort of wide ranging lawsuit for a number of different offenses, including mortgage fraud and manipulation of energy prices. And hours before the press conference, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, called up the number three official at the Justice Department and started to renegotiate, and he ended up paying $10 billion extra dollars, and the whole thing went away. Now, if you can imagine a drug dealer who's the target of a federal criminal investigation calling up a prosecutor and asking him to hold off, that would never happen in a regular criminal case, but that's exactly what happened in a case which turned out to be the biggest settlement in American history.
Yeah, and what it would be the drug dealer, you'd allow the drug dealer to buy his way out of it, to just take the profits, a portion of his drug money, and then pay off and get scot-free, right?
Essentially, that's what happened. I mean, Chase ended up doing a $13 billion settlement, again, which was at least three times bigger than the biggest settlement in history, which was the BP settlement prior to that. That was $4 billion. So this was $13 billion. And the original offer that they had on the table before they announced that press conference was $1 to $3 billion. So essentially, Chase, the CEO, calls up the Attorney General and offers $10 billion more dollars, and the whole thing goes away. An ordinary person cannot do this when they're faced with this kind of situation.
For more Off the Grid, go to Aura.tv every Tuesday through Friday at 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. Now, it's the time you've all been waiting for. He's an acclaimed wrestler, musician, actor, author, and host of his own podcast, Talk is Jericho. He's the first ever WWE Undisputed Champion, as well as the lead singer for the rock band Fozzy. Welcome Chris Jericho to the We the People podcast with Jesse Ventura. Chris, great to have you.
Hey, Jess. Thank you so much for having me, man. I appreciate that intro. That was it had a lot of accolades in there. That's very cool.
Well, not to make fun, Chris, but it sounded like I was introducing myself.
It's funny because you are definitely one of the guys that kind of paved the way for not being just put in the wrestling box, which a lot of people outside of the business, you know, especially in Hollywood, et cetera, actually anything, will always try and limit that. If you're a wrestler, you can't do anything else. But you're one of the first guys that proved that wasn't the case, and I've definitely picked up where you left off as far as not having any inhibitions into trying different things and succeeding in different things outside of the wrestling world, for sure.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I ran into when I started dabbling in Hollywood, because I was a wrestler, they used to make me do my own stunts.
Yeah, well, right. Well, because you do it all the time. Why not, right?
Yeah, because we're qualified. And, you know, Chris, the only reason it stopped, I went to my agent and I said, hey, wait a minute. I want to get stunt pay like stuntmen do. They get extra money if they do this. If I'm doing it, I want to get the stunt adjustment also. And that's what it took to get me to stop having to do stunts. I don't know if you remember. You remember when Roddy Piper and I did that TV pilot?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Roddy and I did all our own stunts and that whole thing. We never used a stuntman because they knew we were capable of doing it. And, you know, it made things better because you didn't have to do hard cuts or anything like that to work in a stuntman because we could just keep the cameras rolling. But I remember I finally fought him and said, you know, I want to get paid for this. Everybody else does.
The thing is, too, though, Jesse, is that with the work ethic you learn from being in the wrestling business and coming through the way that we did, you just did it. Hey, you guys want to do stunts? It's like, yeah, okay, because there's really no you just get the job done. We have a very good work ethic when you come in through the wrestling business. I think that's another reason why people in Hollywood or people in rock and roll or politics, I'm sure, is the same, are always very impressed by our work ethic and never too tired to do an interview or never turn anything down, because you learn early on in your careers, it's like you got to take the opportunities when you get them and you got to work your ass off to keep those opportunities coming in.
Absolutely. I remember one time early in my career, probably before you were almost born, way back in 75, 76, I actually wrestled 63 consecutive nights in a row without a day off. And I mean, there's guys that destroy that record, but when you tell people on the street, yeah, I wrestled 63 nights in a row once, they look at you like, how? And that included what you had to drive back then.
Sure. even tell the guys in the business today that you did 63 nights in a row. I mean, it's unfathomable to think of that. That's just the way the business was. And you didn't ask any questions because that's just how it was, right?
And you didn't get paid unless you wrestled.
Yeah, exactly. There were no guaranteed contracts back then.
Nope. Yep, not at all. Now, how old are you now, Chris?
I'm 43.
Oh, so you're exactly, I'm 63, so you're 20 years younger than me.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. You know, this is a podcast. We're having fun talking. What's the biggest misconception about Chris Jericho, the wrestler? What do you think the biggest misconception about you is?
I think if you're talking, I mean, and I know you can totally understand where I'm coming from when I say this. I think the biggest misconception, especially a couple years ago, when I really was dropped into my heel character, and you'll know what I'm talking about, because when I played a heel, I really used acting techniques that I learned in Hollywood, dropping in, you know, almost method acting where you're really believing what you're doing, and became kind of the most hated guy in the business, to whereas people thought that that was really me, because wrestling's a different type of entertainment. It's unlike any other. It's half show business. It's half real. It's half drama. It's half sports. It's half, you know, Shakespearean morality play. It's half stunt show. So people aren't sure when you're playing a character, when you're not. And I still get people this day that come up to me or say hi to me or whatever and go, wow, you know, I thought you were going to be a real jerk. I thought you were going to be a real, you know, ass, because, you know, you're so bad on TV. And I would always say, you know, Anthony Hopkins doesn't walk down the street in a straitjacket eating people's livers with a fine Chianti. You know, when he played Hannibal Lecter, it was just a part. He wasn't really that guy, but people sometimes still have a problem figuring out the difference between what's real and what's a show.
Yeah, I love to refer to wrestling as ballet with violence.
Yeah.
Because the performers, the wrestlers themselves are tremendous athletes. You know, there's no doubt about it. They're very, very athletic, especially even more so today. And yes, some of it's choreographed. Well, so is ballet. The difference is we're ballet with violence.
You know, I actually even was just on my podcast, I was just sitting around one day and just thinking to myself, if you really boil it down, wrestling technically could be an Olympic sport. And here's why I say this. If you look at figure skating, or if you look at, you know, synchronized swimming, or if you look at gymnastics, it's all a routine, a choreographed routine between two people or one person, or sometimes even three or four people, that's judged by, you know, scored by judges. So if you boil down pro wrestling, what it really is, you and I could go and represent, you know, Team America, put on a match, have the judges score our match, and award, you know, okay, the American team, the Canadian team, the German team, the Russian team, and the American team wins the gold, they get the best score. Wrestling falls into that category the same way the gymnastics or figure skating does, because it is an athletic routine. It's a choreographed routine. Now, there's also a lot of improv in there, a lot of just calling it on the fly. the basic essence of it is it's an athletic routine, like I said, just like figure skating or gymnastics would be. And I think wrestling sometimes gets a little bit undermined because, oh, it's fake. I mean, there's nothing fake about it. Obviously, it's a show. But so are so many other sports that we were talking about that actually are legitimate gold medal winning contests.
Chris, that's amazing because even I've never even thought of that. And it makes perfect sense when you think of the Olympics and many of the events that are totally subjective. They're not objective, they're subjective.
Sure.
It's like diving. You know, I'm a former swimmer, and we used to always say, well, in swimming, you know who wins because it's
right.
Who has the fastest time. There's no doubt there. When Michael Phelps wins, he had the fastest time. But when you shift to diving, that's all subjective. That's judges watching a diver do a routine and, you know, enter the water with the least amount of splash and all these other variables that they have to do well. But that's a great point. I never thought of that. Pro wrestling is an Olympic sport. That would be truly amazing. That would be amazing, but I could see where you could legitimately do it.
Well, yeah, like I said, you could get countries, you know, even the way that, you know, like basketball now has kind of dream teams. All the best players in the NBA will join the American Olympic team or hockey. You could do that in wrestling. Let's say, okay, Canada, you get, you know, Chris Jericho and Edge, let's say. In America, you take, I don't know, you know, John Cena and Randy Orton, and you get the Russian team, and you get the English team, and put together the best team of guys on one-on-one, and have them do their routine, have them do their match, false finishes, the whole thing, and when it's done, you grade it. Wow, that was an 8, that was a 10, that was 5,
well,
just like you would with figure skating. You could actually do it.
Yeah, and Chris, I'd have to say now, I'll be honest with you, I haven't watched a lot in the last decade or so. I've been involved in other stuff, but I would have to state, and I've stated this many times, the greatest match that I ever saw in my entire career was WrestleMania 3, Ricky Steamboat against Randy Macho Man Savage.
I agree.
Well, there may have been some later that can compare to it. I don't know. But in the amount of time I spent in the business, that was the greatest match that I ever had an opportunity to watch. And I still make that claim today that Macho Man and Steamboat in WrestleMania 3. And they weren't even the headliner. The headliner, of course, was Hulk against Andre.
Yeah, but they were definitely the show stealer. And you know, we get asked that quite a bit, whether it's for the WWE Network or from different interviews. What's your favorite match, you know, of all time? And you could say this one, that one, but to me, that still is one that always comes to mind is the Savage and Steamboat. And especially, you know, as a kid, I was probably 15 or 14, and just being, I was a huge Steamboat fan. And you know, not as much of a Savage fan because he was the heel, you know. And back in those days, you still didn't know for sure what was, you know, legit and what was not.
Let me throw this in. So you, as a kid, you did the typical. You sided with the babyface. You sided with the hero.
Well, yeah, but actually, it's a pretty funny story, Jesse. And I'm not just saying this because I'm on your show, but this is a well documented thing. When I was a kid, I used to go to my grandmother's house and we would watch AWA wrestling. I grew up in Winnipeg, Canada. And
good.
my grandmother, the person she hated the most was Jesse the Body Ventura. And she, seriously, she never said too much, but she was always yelling and screaming and, oh, Jesse, oh, this guy's such a jerk, he's such a, and, but to me, like, I would, of course, agree with my grandmother, but deep down inside, I was like, I like that guy, the boas and the jewel and the chin and, that's when I started getting a real appreciation for the characters in wrestling and the fact
sure.
that you could be a puppet master. But
yeah.
you know, I still was a wrestling fan and still liked the good guys, especially, you know, I was a huge Hogan fan when AWA switched over to WWF at the time when I was in Winnipeg. A huge Hogan fan, huge Savage fan when he turned good guy and huge Steamboat fan, you know, and not really knowing why I liked them, but understanding years later is because they had such a great connection with the crowd and all this, that, and the other thing. But it basically all started in my grandmother's basement watching AWA with her yelling at you.
Well, Chris, thanks. I take that as a great compliment. It means I did my job well, that your grandmother
right.
hated me so bad, and that's what I was paid to do. You know, I got to kind of chuckle on this because you and I are opposite on that. When I was growing up, of course, I remember as a kid Vern Gagne against the Crusher. And I remember the Crusher when he was a bad guy, when Vern Gagne was the good guy and Crusher was the bad guy and Mad Dog and all them. But I always cheered for the villains. I mean, the guy who inspired me when I saw him was Superstar Billy Graham. And I had come home from the Navy and I'd been in the Navy, and I came home on leave one time, and my buddies were doing something, and I had nothing to do, and I had a pocket full of money. I'm on home, you know, on leave from the Navy, and wrestling was that night at the Minneapolis Auditorium, and I'll never forget, I went down and walked up to the window, and I said, "Give me the best ticket you have." I was 22 years old at the time. And the lady says to me, I have one in the front row. Are you alone?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm alone." She said, here's the front row." So I paid for it. I sat in the seat. And when superstar Billy Graham come out, and, you know, with the fishnet and the tie-dye, and the first legitimate bodybuilder who had made, the transfer to wrestling with the posing and all that, I sat and watched Graham. And it was right then that it entered my mind. I was getting out of the Navy, and I thought, you know what? Maybe this is the career I need to pursue. And then when I got to college, I got very interested in theater. I was on the GI Bill. And I thought, geez, wrestling fulfills both. It's theater with athleticism. What could be better for my creativeness? And because I wanted that creativity. Well, in football, you don't get that. You got a helmet with your name on the back of a jersey, and that's about all the creativity you're going to see. But wrestling allowed that. So it was superstar Billy Graham, for me, was the guy that inspired me. Do you remember your first pro? Obviously, Chris, you remember your first pro wrestling match. I remember mine. It was with Omar Atlas, Wichita, Kansas, and I got disqualified.
Yeah, my first one was in Ponoka, Alberta, about 2 hours outside of Calgary. Against Lance Storm. It was in the Ponoka Moose Hall, and it was a 10-minute Broadway, 10-minute draw.
You know, I think I got a better start than you. I at least got to go to the Century 2 Auditorium in Wichita, not the Moose Club.
The Moose Hall, man. Yeah, it's funny. I just had Lance on my podcast a couple weeks ago, and we talked about that. And I remember thinking, like, there was probably maybe 75 people there, but to me it was like, oh my gosh, this is like a sold out stadium for me. And I remember going in there, and of course we trained together at the Hart Brothers camp in Calgary. So when we found out we were having our first match, of course we worked out the routines and had the spots ready to go.
Let me interject here. So you're trained by Stu Hart?
Well, here's the thing. By that point in time, Stu wasn't training as much. But there was still the Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling Camp is what it was called. And the trainer was Keith Hart, Stu's son, Keith. But he never showed up. He showed up like on the first day to collect our money, stretched us a few times, and then we never saw him again. So it was a typical Hart Brother Pro Wrestling Camp with no Hart involved.
I only say that because I remember back in the day, Stu had that reputation. I remember one time Brett had this audio tape in a cassette where we were all listening to it in the locker room, and it was Stu and the boys stretching these new guys. And, I mean, you talk about blood-curdling screams. It was worse than any slasher. It was worse than any slasher movie that you could ever imagine, what you listened to.
That made the rounds for years, and all it was, like you said, was an audio cassette, and you'd put it on, and all you heard were, like, the screams of the damned. Like, like you said, it's like, stop. Like, what are you doing to these poor guys? And what they would do, I mean, the whole family was like that. It all started with Stu. They would basically stretch you to see if you had what it took to be in the business. You know, it wasn't just show up, pay your money, and here we go. It was like, okay, you want to be a wrestler? First, you got to see how tough you are. And they would beat the crap out of you and stretch you and, you know, make you do 500 hack squats a day and run backwards for a mile and do nut shot practice and all this sort of crazy stuff. And then if you survive that, you get into the ring. So those screams were just them stretching you. And the more you screamed, the more they would do it. And you should have figured out pretty quickly the only way to have them stop doing that was just try not to scream. Like, I'd try not to make any noise at all, and then they'd get bored and go on to the next guy. So that's how you get out of those shoot holds.
Anyway, throughout your career, I when I was inducted in the Hall of Fame in 2004, one of the things I said, I made the statement who the two guys were that I enjoyed as my opponent the most. And I said it was Tito Santana and Jimmy Superfly Snuka were the two guys I liked to wrestle the most. Chris, do you have a favorite? Do you have favorites of particular guys you thoroughly enjoyed working with the most?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's quite a few guys that come to mind, but I think probably the one that stands out for me was Shawn Michaels. He was my favorite of all time. We just had great chemistry. I grew up as Shawn Michaels was one of my inspirations, and not a hero because he was only a few years older than me, but I always just thought he was the best. Like for what I liked as a performer, as a character, inside the ring, outside the ring, because when I started wrestling, Jesse, it was 1990. It was the era of the big man, as you know, 6'8", sure. 300 pounds, you know, the Hulk Hogan prototype. I'm 5'11". I was maybe 200 pounds. I figured out pretty early on that if I was, I could never be the biggest guy on the show, but I could be the biggest character and have the biggest personality and have the biggest charisma. And I always kind of worked my career that way. And Shawn was another guy who kind of did the same thing. You know, he was another smaller guy that kind of broke into business, you know, despite of his size, not because of it. And when we first started working together, it was just really good chemistry right off the bat. And we did a WrestleMania match at 2003. That was you know, the quote unquote show stealer. But then in 2008 is when it really kicked into gear. That's when I was talking to you about when I was like the most hated guy in the business.
Sure.
He was the perfect foil for me. And we had an 8-month, 9-month feud that Jack Lanza, who you know very well, told me it was the best feud in WWE history, you know, and when Jack said something like that, obviously he'd seen a lot of stuff. So, and he wasn't the only one that felt that way. It was just a really great feud, a great heel, a great baby face, and amazing chemistry.
Now, do you consider yourself a heel or a baby face?
I think to really make it in wrestling, it's just like acting. You know, you have to be able to play both parts. You have to be able to play all the roles. And to be a real, complete, well-rounded package, you have to do both. I love being a babyface. Having said that, I mean, it's a lot easier to make people hate you than it is to make them like you. But once they start hating you, it's the real trick is to keep them hating you because heels are so entertaining and they have such great characters. And if you look at the greatest heels of all time, not just in wrestling, but in movies, Darth Vader, Hannibal Lecter, the Joker, Freddy Krueger, the Terminator, you know, the first movie, they're heels, but they're so entertaining that the next movie, they're always baby faces. If you ever notice that. And oh, yeah. That was the real secret. It was to be able to stay a heel. Anytime people started liking what you were doing, deviate away from that and keep people always not liking you. Like when I was a heel, I wouldn't allow Vince to make merchandise, which, as you know, is a cornerstone of WWE's business is merchandise. I didn't want anybody in the crowd wearing a Chris Jericho T-shirt when they're supposed to be hating me. What's the point? So just little things like that. So I think I enjoyed being a heel more, but I still enjoy being a babyface, but you have to be able to do both.
You know, it's interesting. In my case, I never was a babyface. I was a heel my entire career.
The whole time, and, right.
Yeah, and then when I switched to the broadcasting, I'll never forget it. I had had the pulmonary emboli the night before, blood clots in my lungs the night before I was Wrestle Hogan in L.A., and we were to have a 3-match program all the way around the world, and I missed it, cost me a tremendous amount of money, but sometimes through bad comes good. And because that happened to me, the light went off with Vince, and he knew I was a great talker. So he said, you know, he called me up when I was convalescing, and he said, I got an idea. He said, you think you could be an announcer? And I said, sure I can, Vinny. You know I can talk. He said, I want to try something. I want to put the first villain, the first heel on the mic, who's an out-and-out heel and stays that way. Oh, my God. Chris, you couldn't believe it. I became a babyface within a year or two just being a heel. It was so strange because I would go there and I'd say the most outrageous crap you could imagine trying to stay in my heel image. And all of a sudden, after doing it for a year, I'd come into buildings and I was getting standing ovations. You know, I guess for just telling it like it is.
I can attest to that because, I was a big fan at that time. And it was always cool to hear what you had to say and also to see what you were going to wear. That was always the best part, too. Like, what kind of a crazy costume are you going to be wearing? But there's a guy in Canada. He's an announcer on Hockey Night in Canada. His name is Don Cherry. And he's a similar character to you. He's probably about 80 years old now. He's been doing this for 30, 40 years.
Oh, I know who Don Cherry is.
Yeah, of course you do. And we'd always tune in to this day to hear what he's going to say because he's kind of got the heel thing, but also to see what he's going to wear. and you had the same vibe. You were like the Don Cherry of the WWE, and became we loved Jesse the Body Ventura because you were so, once again, so charismatic, so flamboyant, and the heel then becomes the babyface because you're so much more interesting than the other guys on the panel.
Well, you know what was hilarious about it? I had the greatest job in the world because what other job, Chris, can you go on national TV, insult your boss up and down, and he loves it? It's part of the business. I mean, I had a job where I could insult Vince on a daily basis, and half of the things I said, half of the things I said to him were a shoot. I was being serious when I say it. And, you know, they couldn't distinguish between when I'm giving them a line of crap or whether I'm being legit with Vince. I remember I came back to do a read thing of old times when he brought me back, and the two of us got on the mic together, and Vince kept bragging about how he was a billionaire now. I'm a billionaire. I'm a billionaire. I finally looked at him and said, Vince, I said, you've destroyed a myth that I've had all these years. And he said, what's that? I said that you have to be intelligent to be rich.
Yeah. And then fast forward 15 years, and one of the biggest things that I did when I started the YGJ character was insult his daughter, Stephanie, who was then the on-air girl, and used to come up with just the most horrible, brutal insults about her being a slut and a whore. And, you know, I would come up with these lines like, I'd say to Vince, okay, I'm going to say to Stephanie, you know, Hunter would say something like, you know, like, don't insult my little flower. And I'd say, well, Stephanie lost her flower a long time ago. And Vince would go, okay, you can say that, but just make sure you pause so the crowd reacts accordingly and give them a chance to cheer. So this is Vince talking about his daughter. Yeah, you can say she's a slut and she lost her virginity when she was 15, but just make sure the crowd gets a chance to pop before you move on.
Oh, the one thing
only in wrestling.
Hey, the one thing I give Vince credit for, there is nothing off the table when it comes to making money. Nothing is off the table.
I mean, Vince is ruling. He said it to me, and I'll never ask you to do anything that I wouldn't do. And you would see that. I mean, Vince would anything. He would fall off the side of a cage. He would get sprayed in the face with, you know, stimulated feces or whatever it would be. He never had any, and still doesn't this day, have any type of inhibitions as to what you could do or say to him. So when the time came for you to do something along the same lines, you pretty much had to do it because you knew that Vince would do it. And that's kind of the rule that he has. And it's the same to this day.
You're touring rock and roll now, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, going back to what you were talking about when you were watching wrestling and you're talking about football and how it doesn't have much of an identity. I always loved wrestling because it had a rock and roll element to it. And I've always, when I was a kid, I wanted to be in a rock band and I wanted to be a wrestler. Those are my two dreams. And had everybody in the world tell me I could never do either one of them, and just didn't listen to people that told me I couldn't do something, because I knew that I had a passion for it. I knew that I wanted to do it. So, you know, I started playing in bands when I was 12 and continued to play in bands even when I started wrestling when I was 19, and started Fozzy back in about 2000. And it's been going really, really great over the last couple of years, man. It's been a real worldwide thing.
Fozzy's not named after Ozzy, is it?
No, it started out we were a cover band called Fozzy Osbourne, just playing, you know, cover songs. And it was just kind of a fun thing to do. And because of who was in the band, Chris Jericho and the guys I was playing with had some notoriety on their own, we got a record deal right off the bat just because of who was in the band. And that's when we just kind of dropped the Osbourne and kept Fozzy, which kind of was a weird name. But now it's like, you know, it's the best name in the world because people love to chant it. Fozzy, Fozzy. So it's like, no matter what happens, people chant that name after every song. So it ended up being kind of a smart idea after all.
Well, that's wonderful. So do you anticipate, will you come back to wrestling again?
Well, I mean, my schedule now, Jesse, is just based around whatever Fozzy's schedule is. We've been doing a lot of touring over the last 4 or 5 years around the world. Like I said, I think our last tour was 17 different countries. And so I still come back to the WWE from time to time when we're off the road with Fozzy, but only for short bursts, maybe 3 months, 4 months, something along those lines. Because, you know, like we talked about earlier, you have to diversify yourself. You have to branch out. And I've been lucky that I've had a lot of different opportunities to do things outside of the business. I still love wrestling, but I also love doing these other things too. And I don't want to be wrestling when I'm, you know, having to rely on wrestling for the rest of my life and worried about, you know, if Vince wakes up one day and doesn't like me or fires me or whatever. It's good to have other things going on, especially, you know, when you're talking about, like I said, I've been playing music my whole life and now that the band is doing as good as we are. So I'll come back from time to time, but I think my days as a full-time wrestler are pretty much over at this point.
Well, you're getting to the age where you ought to think about ending it too, because a lot of guys hang on for that year or two or three more, and it can be devastating on your body. I mean, I retired just before I turned 40. I think I was 39. I don't regret it a bit. I do not regret it a bit, because when I look back today and I see some of the guys that stayed those extra 5 or 6 years, oh, do they pay a price with their body when you get 55 or 60? And people need to understand, and Chris, I'll tell this to you, and I'm sure you're aware of it. Life doesn't end when you leave wrestling. You know, in many ways, life begins when you leave wrestling again. You know, it's a new beginning, and there's still a whole lot of life to do out there, and you don't want to be crippled up because you decided to stay inside that ring 5 years longer than you should have.
Well, yeah, you're right about that. And another thing, too, is that, I mean, I've always considered wrestling, I call it show business boot camp. When you come up, you know, we talked earlier about the work ethic you have in the wrestling business, but also all of the different elements that are involved in being a legitimate main event, you know, superstar in the business. You know, you got to know how to do drama, comedy, in front of a live audience, backstage pre-tape, you know, working on the fly, you know, politics, behind the scenes, in front of the scenes. I mean, there's so many things that you learn that you can use in acting or politics or music or, you know, podcasting or whatever it may be, being in front of a camera and knowing how to talk. I mean, it's opens you wide open. I've hosted a couple game shows now, which I never thought I would do, but why not? I mean, wrestling lends itself to that. So there's a lot of opportunities that are available if you have the aptitude, because of all the stuff we've learned in the business that helps you sharpen a lot of those communication skills, a lot of those show business skills. So that's another reason why, I mean, my schedule is always packed with different things, because I get a lot of opportunities. And I attribute a lot of those things that I've learned from directly from the wrestling business, for sure.
Let me ask you this. I haven't kept up with it, as I said, within the last decade. My son knows a whole lot more of what's going on than me, but I understand recently that Vince laid off 11 of his superstars. How did that affect the mood backstage? He fired 11 guys?
That happens from time to time. I'm sure it happened back when you were working too. You know, just like in the old territory days, sometimes guys come in and their run is over. It's just kind of, it's time to move on to the next place. Unfortunately, now there's nowhere else really to go. And, you know, it's just trimming the fat. It's getting rid of guys that have been around for a while that maybe they know, Vince knows, can never get to the next level. And if that's the case, then he needs to make room for guys that, are up and coming. He's got a whole new system now, Jesse, a big minor league program in Orlando, where they have guys training, kind of like a football training camp, like a minor league system. So there's a lot of guys ready to come up, and he just has to make room from time to time. And sometimes the guys that get let go are worthy of being let go, and sometimes they're not. But it's up to those guys to kind of decide if this is what they really want to do and go find other gigs somewhere. But it's just like anywhere else. Sometimes you just gotta clean the slate a bit for some new talent, new people.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Big John Studd used to be a good friend of mine, and we were there when, of course, Vince went national, and we started there. At that time, there were 26 regional promotions, and we started watching them one by one as they started folding and disappearing as Vince took over. And I'll always remember John Studd. Big John would be driving the car, and I'd be riding with him wherever we were going. And I remember when we'd hear a territory fold, Big John's hands would squeeze that steering wheel, and he'd always look at me and he'd go, Jesse, this is bad. This is really bad. If all these territories fold, there'll be nowhere for anyone to go to get work. And unfortunately, that was the evolution of the business. You know, Vince destroyed these other 26 territories, and now when guys get laid off, they have nowhere to go. In my before Vince did that, you had 25 other places you could go and earn a living yet, because it was all regionalized. So it's kind of bad that it did take that national level, but it's kind of like evolution. There was nothing you could do about it. It was going to happen no matter what happened, but the end result isn't always the best for the wrestler, is it?
Well, no, and even when I started, obviously, a generation after you, a lot of those territories were already gone. Most of them were gone. There were still a few here and there. But what I was able to do in the early 90s was go overseas. Once again, because I wasn't the biggest guy, I was a little bit quicker and faster, more athletic, which is perfect for the Mexican style of wrestling, Japanese wrestling, German, all those type of places. So I went around the world before I started working for Vince in 99 and Ted Turner in 96. I'd worked 6 years around the world, pretty much in every country where there was wrestling. And that's where I really learned and cut my teeth and learned different styles and different ideas as far as how to put together finishes and high spots, and also learned a lot of life lessons. Really matured me to be, you know, living in Mexico and living in Japan and these type of places away from home and learning different languages. And that was kind of the way that my generation was able to break in. And unfortunately, that's even closed down now as well, because those countries aren't, you can't make as much money as you used to be able to. But for a young guy just kind of learning the business, I had an amazing you know, kind of upbringing in the business by just being in other countries overseas.
You know, I don't know if you know much about this, Chris, but it's a question that I had written for me here that I find interesting. It says it was also recently announced that the WWE is cutting 7% of its workforce, about 50 to 60 jobs. The move comes after a net loss of $14.5 million in its second quarter, which is attributed to the launch of the company's online subscriber service. Do you think the WWE Network was a good move now in hindsight? Is it going to pay off in the long run after these initial losses?
I think it will, Jesse. I mean, the whole world right now, you know, pop culture world, shall we say, is going through a transition. You can see it in music. I mean, our first record came out in 2000, sold so many copies, but the band is way bigger now in 2014, but sells a fraction of those records because people, it's all based online, iTunes. You know, and people have the option now to just listen to the music for free. Or if you're talking about, you know, DVDs, that's why Blockbuster Video closed down, because people can just watch it on Netflix or just basically steal it themselves. It's like that all across the board. I think the biggest thing with the WWE Network is the technology, and people still aren't sure exactly how to use it. I know that if my dad is going to talk about the WWE Network, or let's say there was an NHL Network or NFL Network, I don't think he would get it because it's technology that he doesn't quite understand, even though it's probably pretty easy to figure out. I think over the next 5 or 10 years, as more and more people get used to the fact that most of our entertainment will just be online on computers rather than having to go buy an actual DVD or buy a CD, I think the network will start to grow. But it's those growing pains, man. I mean, the stock went down. You're going to love this. The stock went down overnight a couple months ago to where it went down so significantly in one night that Vince lost $350 million in one night.
Wow. I hope it doesn't go down too bad because I own a lot of that stock.
Yeah, you better check into it, man. You might have lost a couple bucks. But, I mean, that's just the way that the world
well,
is. We're kind of one foot in the past, one foot in the future.
Yeah, Chris, the good thing is you don't lose it till you sell it.
Yeah, so you still got
the
it. Stock, so hold on
so,
to it.
Oh, yeah, I've got it, and I don't need it. So I'll let it sit there till it builds its way back up again, hopefully. But, yeah, I haven't checked on it for a while. If it did take the dip, I'm sure. But, you know, Vince will survive. That's one thing about him. But anyway, Chris, we're coming to a close now. I'll tell you, this is flowing by, you know, talking wrestling with you. It's been a great time, Chris, to talk with you a generation or two behind me and get your perspective. I wish you well in all your endeavors. You're a bright guy. You're going to do just fine. But we always finish my podcast with a little fun. Are you ready to have a little fun, Chris?
Absolutely. Even more than I've been having? Are you kidding me? Is that possible?
Absolutely. Okay, here's the fun. We go to a segment called If I Were President. So now the segment will be If I Were President with Chris Jericho. And I've got, now these are rapid response, Chris. Don't think too much about them. They're all in fun. But give me your rapid responses to these questions. And of course, don't take them too seriously. Otherwise, it's no fun. Okay?
All right.
First question. If Chris Jericho was president, number one, what would be the first thing you'd do in the Oval Office?
I think what I would do to kind of to get rid of some of the deficit, I don't even partake, but I think I'd make marijuana legal. I think if cigarettes can be legal and alcohol can be legal, I think they should legalize marijuana, and then they would get rid of all the deficit and taxes, especially in California. And I'm not even a marijuana smoker. I just think it's just an open area to make some money and get the country back on track.
Wow, that's the first thing you'd do.
Amazing. And you're not even a pot smoker? I would figure you had to be a pot smoker if that's the first thing you'd do.
Anyway, okay. Question number two. You're the president now, Chris.
Yeah.
Who's the first person you'd hire, and for what job?
First person I would hire, I'd hire Paul McCartney to be my personal assistant, just so I could hear stories about the Beatles and just hear about his life. Because I never got to meet him, so the only way I get a chance to hang out with him and meet him is by hiring him. I'm a huge Beatles fanatic, and that's the one guy in my life I never got a chance to run across. So what better way to do it? I'd hire him and be his boss, and then he would have to do whatever I tell him to do.
And now you answered my second question, or third question. The third question was first person you'd want to meet.
Paul McCartney.
But
there
now,
you
but
go.
I don't want to just meet him, Jesse. I want to be his boss. And then I have to tell him what his hours are, tell him what he has to do. He has to go get me coffee. Like, just really get involved with that. Really stick it to him, you know?
I hate to tell you, Chris, but I don't think Paul would accept your hiring
under those circumstances.
Well, I'd pay him minimum wage. I mean, come on, man. What does he need? And I'll, you know, yeah.
Well, here's something along the same lines, fitting right in. If you could choose one song as your inaugural song, what would it be?
Wow, man, there's so many great songs that you could choose. But I'd probably choose our new Fozzy song, "Lights Go Out." It's top 40. But if I could make it the inaugural song, I could make it number one. So that'd be kind of a different form of nepotism. It'd be like music nepotism, where I'm just playing my own music and shoving it down everybody's throats and making them buy it. There you go. I would make that part of the taxes. You have to spend 99 cents on iTunes to buy my song. And that way my song would be like one of the biggest selling songs of all time. It will almost be kind of like a communist type of a thing. But if I'm president, I can do what I want. And
sure.
Also, another thing I want to do, too, is I want to find out about Area 51. That's another thing. I want the general to come tell me about Area 51 and tell me what exactly is in there, how many aliens are in there, what ships are in there, and find out the whole kind of secret behind that.
I tried. I couldn't get in the door on conspiracy theory.
In fact,
they got a line in the sand out there. If you cross it, you got to go face down and straight to jail.
I'll tell you what, when you do my podcast, that's what I want to talk about is conspiracies, man, because I am so into all that stuff. I watch conspiracy theory, and I love the fact that they never really let you in anywhere. You'd be outside looking in the window, trying to get in second.
Oh, yeah, and then that was an amazing show to do. Anyway, we'll finish now. We're done with the inaugural song. Here's the fifth. Now, I don't know why they wrote this for me. This is kind of self-serving. Where would I fit in your cabinet, Jesse Ventura?
Well, there you go. I mean, I got Paul McCartney as my personal assistant, and I've got you, and you and I will go, and we'll find out Area 51. We'll get to the bottom of all the 911 conspiracies. Like, you'll be my official conspiracy taskmaster, and we'll actually go get to the bottom of these things, not just on a show, like governmently. We'll go and actually pass bills and pass, we'll go to Capitol Hill, and I'm showing my political ignorance here, but we'll find out the real story behind these things, and they won't be able to say no to us because we'll be a task force.
You know, that ain't a bad idea, and then we could actually find the truth on a few things instead of all the bullshit we get.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be perfect.
Okay, we got to end that, but let's go. We've got some Facebook questions for you, Chris. You ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay, this is from Chris Murphy. He asks, which politician would you quote Walls of Jericho first?
Well, I mean, I try and stay out of politics. I'm from Canada, where politics is a lot different. I'm not even too sure who the prime minister of Canada is right now, which is so ridiculous. But I'm not a big fan of the whole Obamacare thing. It's kind of really bothering me. So I'd probably put him in the Walls of Jericho just about the Obamacare, because I know what it's like from growing up in Canada, and it's not the be-all, end-all that some people think it is. It's probably good in some ways, but overall, it kind of takes away a lot of options for a lot of people, too. So that's that Obama. I'll give it to him just for the heck of it, too.
Okay. Ryan
There's
Steinberg.
Your Jericho challenges Obama right there.
There you go.
Ryan Steinberg wants to know, if you were chosen to depict a Marvel or DC character in a comic book movie, who would you choose to portray? Which Marvel or DC comic book character would you like to be, Chris?
I'm going to go with Aquaman. Aquaman doesn't get a lot of respect. And whenever I tell people, like when I was a kid, I thought Aquaman was the best. I just love he could swim, he could talk to sharks, he could get whales to like do stuff for him. And everyone thinks Aquaman's the worst superhero, but I love Aquaman. He's got blonde hair. I've got blonde hair. He's a strapping guy. I'm a strapping guy. So I think I want to do the Aquaman blockbuster film starring Chris Jericho as the Master of the Sea.
Okay. Jeremy Kimball asks, if he could front one legendary band, whom would it be and why? I think you already answered that.
Well, yeah, I don't think I could front the Beatles. It's not, I mean, that's a whole different world. If James Hetfield from Metallica was sick one night and couldn't sing, I could replace him for one night just to say I was the singer of Metallica. But I don't play guitar, so I'd have to have him still play guitar. So if he had a sore throat, but he could still play guitar, then I would sing and do one night with Metallica and Jericho.
Okay, Jeremy Krotz asks, will he let Jesse sing backup live in a concert? Would you let me sing with you?
I've seen you on, I think it was A Land of a Thousand Dances, and your vocals were less than stellar. So if you take a few lessons, then you can come join backups. If not,
now,
you're welcome to play tambourine.
Now, wait a minute, Chris. I played drums with Carlos Santana on Supernatural.
That's right. So there you go. You can play drums.
And it doesn't end there. I sang a duet with Warren Zevon at my inauguration.
Wow. Okay, now here's something. My best friend he's obsessed with Warren Zevon. So I'm going to tell him that you sang with Zevon at your inauguration. What song did you do?
Oh, well, of course we did Werewolves of London. I want to do Rolling the Headless Thompson Gunner. That's my favorite. But we ended up doing Werewolves of London.
My friend flip out. Yeah.
Okay. Rick Dixon wants to know, Canada or America, United States, which is home?
Well, I mean, I live in America, but, you know, I'm always Canadian. You grow up in Canada, and that's you never grow out of that. So I'm Canadian, man. I consider myself Canadian. I'm a proud Canadian. But, you know, I love living in the States, though.
Chris, can I hear you say A once?
What are you talking about, eh? What's going on, Jesse? When are you coming back to Winnipeg, eh? Polo Park Inn.
I used to use that whenever I'd wrestle in Toronto. I'd say, what's the matter with these Canadians? They've never learned the alphabet. No matter what you say to them, they answer with A, never B, C, or D. Just A. Anyway, David Breland asks, how do you feel about a gay character in the WWE?
I think we had a couple of them over the years. Some of them actually shoot gay characters. So, yeah, it doesn't bother me at all. I think in this day and age, I mean, what's the big deal, you know?
Exactly. Let's move quick here. Beano Stein asks, Chris, can you understand CM Punk's decision to leave WWE the way he did?
Well, I mean, I understand what it's like to be burned out on wrestling. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I've left quite a few times. The only thing is I didn't leave in the middle of my contract. I believe in finishing my contracts and finishing my commitments. He didn't feel the same way. So, I mean, but who knows? You know, you can't – whatever is going on in his head, if he wasn't happy, that's the bottom line, and you got to make a change in your life. And he did that. So, you know, he did what he had to do to stay sane. And anybody that's been on the road for a long period of time knows it's crazy being on the road, and sometimes you just need a break.
Yep. Finally, gee, we get a political one. You ready for this, Chris?
Uh-oh.
Jacob Steinbrook wants to know, do you sense a strong libertarian vibe among past and current WWE superstars, with guys like Kane and Val Venus being so openly libertarian? Is that a common sentiment among pro wrestlers?
Once again, man, like, I am the least political guy. I will say this, though. I learned a lot about Ron Paul from Val Venus and Kane. Kane is actually, I think he campaigns for Ron Paul every year. So Kane's 6'10", 350 pounds. So whoever he wants to campaign for, then I am for by proxy. So go Ron Paul, go libertarian, and just don't beat me up, Kane.
Okay. Chris, I want to thank you very much for being part of my second podcast in history. It's truly been a pleasure to get your perspective. You're a very talented guy. I wish you well. Good luck in your careers outside of wrestling, and good luck if you decide to go back to it, okay?
Thank you so much, Jesse. I appreciate it. It's been an honor to be on your show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, and I'd love to do yours sometime, so get in touch with my people, and I'll be happy to do your podcast, too, if you'd like me to.
I'd love to, man. We're working on it now, so I'm sure I'll be talking to you soon.
Okay, very good. There's our thank you to Chris Jericho, one of the most talented WWE performers in history who not only performed in the WWE, but has gone above and beyond. I love that when I see wrestlers who can grow beyond wrestling and continue to perform at a high level. That's it for today. I want to thank again my guest, Chris Jericho, for joining me on the second edition of We the People podcast. Listen to us both on iTunes. And as always, with all my listeners, stay vigilant out there.
This is Corolla Digital.